You seek the key, but first you must learn the ways of precision, craft, and performance with Acura's all-electric ZDX. With a premium Bang & Olufsen sound system, up to a 313-mile range, and a Type S variant with an estimated 500 horsepower, the ZDX is their most powerful SUV yet. Unlock the energy when you visit Acura.com to order yours today.
Hear that? It's the call of the Crave. And when the Crave calls, you know what to do. Try the $5 bacon bundle, because the only thing better than a White Castle slider is a White Castle slider topped with crispy hickory smoked bacon. So pick any two of either the bacon cheese slider, 1921 bacon cheese slider, or chicken bacon ranch slider. And also get a small fry for just $5 with the $5 bacon bundle. White Castle. Follow your Crave.
Cal Newport has wrote such great books about basically how to be more productive and more creative and more, like, well, the titles of the books speak for themselves. So Good They Can't Ignore You, Deep Work, and this latest one is called Slow Productivity. How basically by going slower and in sometimes doing nothing, you ultimately succeed in getting more productive. And he tells how and why. And we always have an interesting conversation. So here is Cal Newport.
This isn't your average business podcast, and he's not your average host. This is the James Altucher Show.
So Cal, I feel like, correct me if I'm wrong, I feel like you were on this podcast yesterday. Like, when was your last book out?
Oh, God. 2 years ago.
2 years ago? So you must have come on around then.
I guess so, but I write a lot of books, so who knows? It could have been the book before that. Like, the last book came out during the pandemic, so that was weird. So it's not like a normal launch. But yeah, it was either for that book or the book before.
And that was, I think it was that book. It was Digital Minimalism?
No, see, I had a book in between that and this.
What was that book?
A World Without Email.
I feel like we did talk about that.
We might have.
I feel you've been on 3 or 4 times at this point.
Yeah.
So this is like the 4th or 5th time. Your first were on like in 2016 with with Deep Work.
Yeah, it would have been like Deep Work or So Good They Can't Ignore You. Yeah, those books. Yeah.
Yeah, I think we combined it because I really like both of those books. And of course, Slow Productivity. This is like my theme song. Like, this is how I live my life, is slow productivity. And everything you mentioned in this book works, but I love the stories you tell in the book, like about John McPhee, Benjamin Franklin, Jewel. And correct me if I'm wrong, and this is where we could begin the discussion, which is that there's this idea with work that, hey, the more hours you put in, the more you'll get done. And if you're not doing anything, you're like a slacker. But your point is that less is more.
Yes. I mean, I think that's a central theme. And let me say also, just more generally first, you know, I'm glad you like the stories, because there's a backstory to how I thought about this book, which was I got tired of citing studies in books. Yes. I just got tired of that format. Most of us, it's meaningless for most people. Most authors can just find social psych studies that vaguely connect. And I could not write again. Team of researchers from University of Pennsylvania looked into this and found out that your creativity, I couldn't do it anymore. I think that the actual social scientist can do this very well. So I was like, why don't I just let the actual social scientist quote studies? And so I realized we can get just as much wisdom, I think, out of people's stories, right? I mean, we have a human instinct for understanding people and their stories, and a novelistic approach almost just felt more real. I just got tired of citing studies. So anyways, I'm glad you pointed that out. There's no studies. No studies in the book.
Let's say the category of this book is sort of a business self-help. Then I would say there are two types of books. There's the ones, like, let's say Brené Brown's books on vulnerability, or I really love Angela Duckworth's book, Grit. But these kind of, there are some stories, but they also have a lot of studies, which is good too, because it sort of proves that they're going to explain these studies and kind of plain English and sort of give prescriptive advice based on what the research shows. But then you have like Seth Godin, Ryan Holiday, Malcolm Gladwell, you, where I think the stories are very moving and very important and kind of speak to the common sense, which the studies just try to prove anyway.
Yeah, and the key difference between the first group and the second group is that first group of authors you mentioned, this is their field. So yeah, Brené Brown studied vulnerability as a researcher. Angela studied grit. Like, that's what she did. And so then it's like, great. It's like, you know, if I'm going to read a Danny Kahneman book, great. I want to hear about the stuff you did that won you a Nobel Prize. But I'm not a social scientist. So yeah, I like that. Right. So I like that category. Ryan's good at that. Malcolm's good at that for sure. The human condition. Like, you get into a story, you try to understand what's going on. We shouldn't downplay the power of that. Like, we shouldn't be too much into scientism and think there's not as much power in story. I think there is. There's something cool there.
You know, I was once on John Stossel's TV show. I don't know if he's even still on the air, but he had a TV show where he's largely like skeptical of lots of things going on in society. And there was an economist on the show with me, and the economist kept citing studies. And like, as Professor So-and-so said, blah, blah, blah. And then during the commercial break, John Stossel turned to him and said, just say it. Don't say the study. We don't need that. Like, yeah, just say what you think.
Yeah. Like, this is bad. I like this, you know, just go for it. Yeah. I'm with you.
Yeah. And so, but the study is really brought to mind. Like, that's when you start to relate it to yourself. Like, do I do this? Do I not do this? And it made me think of a lot of different questions. So maybe describe what you mean by slow productivity, other than my comment, less is more. And then I can go into the stories, and I just have questions, because although I feel like this has been sort of my MO, the slow productivity concept, it hasn't always been, and for good reason.
Yeah. Well, I mean, I think of slow productivity as the answer to the question, how do I do work that I'm proud of and it's impactful and allows me to, you know, support myself and support my family without burning out and without work taking over all aspects of my life? Like, that's a question a lot of people, especially in knowledge work, have been asking, especially starting the pandemic period, which put a lot of existential queries into people's heads. Slow productivity was my answer to that. So how do I solve that riddle? Here's one answer. It's a philosophy of organizing your work and your goals and work that I think answers that question. You produce stuff that you're really proud of and matters, and you don't burn out, and work doesn't become a totalizing force in your life. You know, that's the whole goal.
So some jobs lend themselves to that. Like, for instance, when I was a computer programmer, and this was when I was much younger, I could program everything I needed to do for the week, like in an hour or two, and then the rest of the week was sort of mine without my bosses really knowing that. But some jobs, if you're a secretary, for instance, you have to be on, you're literally on call almost 24 hours a day.
Yeah. So we definitely have there's a variety of knowledge jobs. But more than you think, I think slow productivity is relevant. Right? Because it's part of what's going on with slow productivity. It's, and I think this is a misunderstanding people have, is they think it's about completing less things. Like, okay, I'm going to just do less things. I'm going to be producing less things. I will be less valuable to my clients or my boss, but I'm going to be less valuable because I want to reclaim things that are valuable to me personally. It's not actually such a zero-sum dynamic, because my underlying argument is the way we're working now, like the fast productivity that we implicitly put into place, we're busy, but the rate at which we actually produce useful things is a lot lower than we realize. And so when you embrace a slower approach to productivity, this is the paradox that keeps coming up in the book, you can end up to the outside world seeming phenomenally productive. Like, it's actually a good strategy, not just for your soul, it's also a good strategy for, you know, your bottom line. And both of those things are true at the same time.
Yeah, like, I mean, like a classic example, it's interesting. You talk about many famous writers throughout the book, and particularly towards the end, it's like writer after writer who had this approach. But writing is a classic example. Let's say you write 300 words a day, which once you're, you know, I'm not going to say for every professional writer this is true, but that's not necessarily a hard thing. And 300 words a day is roughly a page. It's a book a year, and after 20 years, you have 20 books. Then you seem like the most, and you give the example of John McPhee with 29 books. Even though he spent 2 years on one article, he had also wrote 29 books along, you know, in his career. So you could amass like what seemed like an enormously productive career of many, many books, but spend an hour or two a day writing only. And that's kind of like the myth of productivity is that it looks different on the outside than what it is on the inside.
Yeah, I mean, it's why I open with McPhee, right? Because I use him as a purified example of slow productivity. And I open not just on McPhee, but like a particular week in his life in the late 60s, working on an article, a two-part series for The New Yorker. And he spent the entire week laying on a picnic table in his backyard, looking at a tree, just thinking, like, how do I, he was working about how do I structure this article? He spent a whole week just laying on his back, looking up at the tree. And I was like, let's think about this. If you zoomed into this week, you came, like, time traveled back, went to his backyard in Princeton, you'd be like, look at this lazy guy. Like, this is the opposite of being productive. He's not doing anything. And yet you zoom out to today, you're like, oh my God, he's one of the most productive writers, you know, of all time. So the key trick of the book, that's why I opened on McPhee, this like super purified, clarified version, is it's easy to imagine, like I did until I sort of had a conversion on this, that these stories like McPhee are drenched in nostalgia and unapproachability. Wouldn't it be great to be a New Yorker writer in the 60s and like you could do this? Too bad we can't do that today. And the whole setup for the book is, what if actually not the particular approach, and you can't lay on a picnic table for a week necessarily, but what if the same idea of being less busy and doing a lot less right now in the moment could be compatible with over time you being a very productive person, someone who produces a lot of stuff and is very successful? What if that's way more widely applicable? And in fact, what if it's applicable to jobs that use computer screens and desks and Zoom? And it's like the whole program of the book is, how do we isolate these principles from traditional knowledge workers who seemingly have nothing in common with a modern knowledge job? How do we isolate principles from how they approached work and then apply them to these modern jobs? And, you know, my argument is you can do this more than you suspect, that there's a principle in John McPhee laying on his back for a week that we can actually adapt if, you know, you work in the marketing department at General Mills. That there's timeless principles we pull out of stories and we have to do work to adapt them. We're not mimicking how Jane Austen wrote books, but there's a lesson in how Jane Austen wrote books, or how Georgia O'Keeffe unlocked her creativity. There's lessons in that if we're careful, we can adapt to a job that's in a cubicle or has a Slack account.
And I think I'll extend that a little, which is that everybody is a creative of some sort or other, or has that latent creative ability inside them. But often if you have distractions, and you comment stories on this throughout the book, if there's distractions, you might not be able to really have your full creative potential, but you still have to make a living, you still have responsibilities, and the stories in your book and the ideas in your book try to meld these concepts together into something functional.
Yeah, I mean, I think that's the whole challenge, because I mean, what's really going on? And my bit of sort of work culture critique, you know, early in the book is, here's the whole setup for the trouble we're in right now, is that knowledge work as a sector emerges as a major thing mid 20th century. The term knowledge work is coined in 1959. All right, so this idea that we're going to have a major sector of the economy where people don't build things with their hands but add value to information using their brains, it's relatively new. So this thing emerges in the post-war period, and we have this issue of, how do we manage knowledge workers? Well, if you look to the industrial sector, which was ascendant, right, this productivity miracle, right, it was generating the wealth on which the modern world was built, they had these really quantitative and clear definitions of productivity. It's Model T's per labor hour input, right? You had numbers and ratios, and I'm using this production system and it produces this number of Model T's per labor hour, and we tweaked this and that number went up, so this is better, so now we're going to do this. I mean, it was very quantitative. Knowledge work emerges and they realize this doesn't work. Like, knowledge workers don't sit there and each produce a Model T. They do four or five different things, and what you're doing is different than what I'm doing. And the system by which we organize and approach our work is obfuscated. That's all left up to the individual to figure out how to organize themselves and manage their time. So there's not even a system we can evaluate in a clear way. We didn't have any of that. And so almost in a panic, is my argument, that almost in a panic, the managerial class said, well, let's just use what I call pseudo-productivity. Visible effort will be our proxy for productivity, right? If I just see you doing things, that's better than you not doing things. And if we need more productivity, then do more things. Like, we'll make the workday longer or say, come in early. And that's what we did for decades. And like, it kind of worked, you know, okay, Mad Men 1960s. It's like, show up at the office and be there and then take the train home. And it worked okay. until we got portable computing and the internet. And now suddenly I could bring work home with me, and email gave me a chance to demonstrate visible activity at any moment, whether I'm at the office or not. And I think that's when the wheels came off. And so it's the opening critique of the book is that pseudo-productivity plus technology made knowledge work increasingly untenable. And that's where we began to get, rising through the 2000s, this sense of, I'm exhausted, I'm burnt out, office space, Mike Judge office space style, existential nihilistic despair of like, what is my job even? I'm just like sending emails between meetings. Like, what am I even doing here? All of that picks up in the 2000s. And I think it's because technology interfacing with pseudo-productivity, this crude heuristic, they didn't play nice together. And knowledge work has been unsustainable ever since. And almost everything we're doing now is trying to grapple with that reality. Like, how do we grapple with that reality? And it's clearly causing a lot of trouble. A lot of the suggestions that people are coming up with are not getting to the core of the problem, but we all kind of care about this now. And it's, you know, it's what we have to figure out. It is the central problem of this style of work right now.
Well, I mean, and a lot of this then came to a head with the pandemic, where people suddenly started working from home, and now they just don't want to go back. Like, they like working at home. And are people more productive now? I mean, this actually does lend itself to scientific study. Like, are people more productive now? Are they less productive? Is the work higher quality? Like, what's the story?
It's mixed results, which tells us clearly it was not a panacea. So there's certain things people like better about working from home. If you survey people, the strongest signal you get, which I don't think is at all counterintuitive or surprising, is they want flexibility. So actually, the dominant mode of working right now, so where we restabilized after the pandemic, is hybrid. Gallup has great data on this. They surveyed 18,000 employees every 3 months throughout the whole pandemic, and they can plot these trend lines. And essentially, we went predominantly remote May of 2020, and then hybrid just came until now it's the majority. Twice as many people are hybrid as remote. It's now the dominant mode of work. If you survey people, they say, yeah, I want flexibility. Not necessarily exclusive remote, but they're like, I want flexibility, which I think is kind of like asking people, you know, do you want extra options for dinner? You know, it's like, yeah, sure. Right.
Well, why do they want to go back to the office at all?
Because they also, a lot of people didn't like being fully remote either. So it's interesting. It's a hybrid future. Actually, the trend line of exclusively remote work, it jumps from a very low percent to something like 60% of all jobs May 2020. It's back down in the 20s again. It's hybrid, right? So we're not really remote. We really are hybrid. There's a couple things hidden here, though, that I think are important. I think one, the reason why there was so much battles over remote work or hybrid work in like 2022, early 23, after any sort of health threat of the pandemic wasn't a big factor anymore, is that it came from that original problem I talked about. Knowledge work was becoming untenable because of pseudo-productivity plus technology, and people just wanted some sort of reform. Like, we got to do something. Here's something we can do. I really think that was a lot of the remote work battles of early 2022, was people just saying, I want some control. We got to change something. And it turns out just changing the location of work doesn't get to the core of this issue. But I think that's where a lot of that came from. There's also a lot of ways that this has made things worse. In particular, it increases administrative overhead. So if I can't talk to you in the hallway, we're going to do a meeting. But if I do a meeting, what's the default interval on my calendar is 30 minutes. So now we have all of these extra 30-minute meetings all over our calendars because I can't grab you in the hallway. And that has a lot of trickle-down effects. There's a Microsoft report that was showing, I know it's ironic, I'm quoting studies now after what I said before.
No, but it's interesting about this half hour thing, how that's the default time interval of a Zoom meeting. So, I think it's 15 minutes. You can go down to 15 minutes.
It is,
minutes.
But it's hard. It's hard. Yeah. You have to have dexterity. It's funny. Right. It's like a dexterity issue. It's hard to do on a trackpad. The 15-minute interval is hard to drag. So you just drag 30. So there's something like a 252% increase in virtual meetings, you know, from 2020 to today. So it's kind of a mess right now. And I think it's because none of this stuff is getting to the fundamental issue, which is, you know, we are burnt out from pseudo-productivity plus having this type of technology. Just shifting where we do work doesn't get to the problem. I mean, I've said, if you're going to fix one thing right now, fix workloads. Location, well, fine. I've scheduled flexibility is fine. Workloads is the problem. Concurrent obligations on your task list is where my book starts on the second part. That's where I think we have a much bigger issue.
Yes, it's totally true. Airbnb has changed my life. If anything, they have made my life so much better. Like, I used to live in Airbnbs. I lived in over 100 or 200 different Airbnbs over a three-year period, and I loved it. I became a really good guest of Airbnbs, and I got to know lots of hosts. So when I initially owned a house, Of course, the first thing I thought was, I'm going to turn my house into an Airbnb because I travel a lot. So why leave my house unused when I can make a side income by letting others Airbnb my house or come to stay in my house as guests? And having my own Airbnb or being a host for Airbnb has allowed me to do just that. And I've met other hosts. I've actually spoken at Airbnb's host conference. I think it was in 2017. I met so many just nice hosts. It's a great community. And I love, you know, turning my own home into an Airbnb. Like, I'm traveling to Austin next month. My home's going to be an Airbnb while I'm away, and I'll stay in an Airbnb. I'd rather stay in like a three-story house Airbnb than in one tiny hotel room in the middle of Austin during South by Southwest. So listen, while you're away, your home could be an Airbnb. Many people host on Airbnb, but there are people who are just letting their house sit empty, who've never thought about it or didn't realize their space could be an Airbnb. Hosting can easily fit into your lifestyle and is a great way to earn some extra money. So if you have a home, but you're not always at home, then you have an Airbnb. Your home might be worth more than you think. Find out how much at airbnb.com/host. I remember last year I was asked to go speak at the Norway Business Summit, and I was so excited because side by side with the Business Summit was the Norway Chess Summit, where I would get to see in person Magnus Carlsen, the best chess player ever, playing chess. But it was 4 plane rides, like, to get to the city that ultimately I would go to. So I really did not want to fly for 14 hours, and they were willing to pay for everything for me. So I at first class. So I didn't want to fly for 14 hours and not be first class. So I had to hurry up and get on the phone immediately to get those first class tickets to a chess tournament in Norway. And listen, this is just like when, you know, you have to know when you want the best of anything, you have to act quickly or someone else will get it instead. And I did not want those seats to fill up. So it's like if you're hiring for your business, you want to find the most talented people for your open roles before the competition scoops them up. I just was talking to a friend this morning where he was trying to decide between some programmers and he waited a little too long and both the programmers he was interviewing took other jobs, like great jobs. So, you know, what's the best way then to hire the best as quickly as possible? ZipRecruiter. ZipRecruiter finds qualified candidates fast. And right now, you can try it for free at ZipRecruiter.com/James. Just try it and see. You'll find out. So ZipRecruiter's powerful matching technology takes center stage to identify the top talent for your roles. Immediately after you post your job, ZipRecruiter's smart technology starts showing you qualified people for it. And I know this because one time I signed up as an employee, potential employee on ZipRecruiter, and I got nonstop, really, I was, even though obviously I wasn't looking for a job, I love what I do, but I just wanted to see what would happen because they were a sponsor of my podcast. And the most interesting jobs would pop up in my emails like, hey, you're qualified for this or that. And so it's interesting to see. So just go there and try it. Try ZipRecruiter.com/James. Amp up your hiring performance. Now, this is more for if you're hiring, but amp up your hiring performance with ZipRecruiter and find the best fast. See why 4 out of 5 employers who post on ZipRecruiter get a quality candidate within the first day. Just go to this exclusive web address right now to try ZipRecruiter for free. ZipRecruiter.com/James. Again, that's ZipRecruiter.com/James. ZipRecruiter, the smartest way to hire. like a lot of people do a lot of things now. Like you give the story of our mutual friend, Jenny Blake, she had 10 different sources of income and she had to figure out, she was burning out. She had to figure out what to do. But let me ask you first, what's you have a lot of concurrent things going on. Like you're a writer for The New Yorker. You write these books, you know, one every 2 or 3 years. You are a computer science professor slash researcher, you know, and then probably have lots of other things going on too. What's your day like? Like, how do you structure your day?
Well, I mean, I would say I don't have a lot going on. I do two things. And like, I figured this out when I was an undergrad. I said, here's what I'm going to do. I'd signed my first book deal as an undergrad and had my grad school acceptance letter. And I was like, this is what I'm doing. I'm going to write and do computer science. And that's what I've been doing now for, God, it's coming up to 20 years. I'm getting old. But I've been very focused on that. I write, I do computer science. Now, what happens is when you stick with the same thing over a long period of time, sequentially, you do different things. Like I wrote this book, and then I did a bunch of magazine writing, then I wrote that book. You're doing these things sequentially over time, but when someone then retrospectively looks at your career, you push them together. And then you imagine, like, you're doing all these things at the same time. But actually, I think about what I'm doing as being much more focused. I do two things. I'm a professor and a writer, and I've really, you know, tried to keep that focus. And so my week looks like that, too. You know, I have on-campus days when I'm teaching. I do all sorts of my Georgetown administrative meeting with students and paper reviews and Georgetown stuff I do on those teaching days. And then I also have, you know, much more writing-focused days. Like, I'm just thinking and I'm writing. The only new thing I've added in 20 years is podcasting. And my rule there was it gets a half day a week. And it's not allowed to take up any more time than that. And if I want to do something new with my show, I have to figure out a way to make that fit. So if I have to hire someone to take something else off my plate, sure, it has to fit in a half day a week. So I have a half day a week podcasting, and then I have sort of on-campus days and deep work days. And that's my schedule.
How many podcasts do you release a week?
One.
Okay. So it seems like just from reading the book, and there's lots of techniques in the book, and there's lots of suggestions in the book, and I still want to get to some of the stories that I'm curious about. It seems overall like there's two techniques. One is delegate. And that's where we see, for instance, Benjamin Franklin's story a little bit. Another technique is structure your day based on, in a weird way, knowing who you are. So for instance, my day, before noon, I don't respond to anybody, nobody calls me. I don't even have my phone around me. No email, nothing. I just am focused on whatever it is I'm doing creatively, whether it's writing or something else. And then between, let's say, noon and like 3 or 4 o'clock is podcast. Like we're doing this podcast right now at 2 p.m. because you still need to be creative, but it's not like, it's kind of like shared creativity. Like I'm talking to you and it's a little easier than, let's say, writing a book. And then after that, I return like business-related calls because, again, not that business is easy, but it's not rocket science. You know, I have 30 years experience. I could do phone calls and I don't need to be like have super high energy at that point. And so that's me scheduling and structuring my day. Very rarely will I switch from that format. And that's how, if I'm productive, like if I produce output in each one of those time frames, then it looks like I'm amazingly productive.
Well, and also that structure you have on your time is implicitly a back pressure on your commitments as well. Like you might not think about it this way. Like I have an exact count of what types of things I work on and how many things I work on, but you figured out this is a reasonable day that over time is going to produce a lot of good stuff. Be creative, do podcasts, finish your business calls, like normal end of day, then be done. This is probably 1,000 times without you even really realized it, been the back pressure that got you to say no to other opportunities. Because your mind is thinking, if I took on this, where's that going to fit? That's going to take a lot of time. Where's that time going to come from? Well, I'm going to have to take away the creative time in the morning. I'm going to have to work later. So there's something to being really clear and structured about this is my day. Like I commit to investing in these things, these time, carefully chosen, and just let that aggregate for a year and good stuff's going to happen. And in 10 years, it's going to be very impressive. That's going on as well. Yeah. So do fewer things and then be very intentional about how you structure and approach those fewer things. that's it, right? That's the recipe to slow productivity. Everyone who, not everyone, but most people who you find stories of who have produced this super productive, interesting stuff, that's kind of what they're doing.
And one thing that's tricky though is that being younger is different than being older. So being in your 20s is different than being in your 30s, 40s, 50s. So, and this is where the Benjamin Franklin story comes in. So when he was in his 20s, that guy was just like kicking ass. Like he had his publishing house. He was writing books. He started franchising his publishing to other cities.
He was like Elon Musk of the 18th century.
Right. He was doing a lot of things. Like, and it's not like travel or Zoom was around, you know, to set up a publishing house in Boston and South Carolina while he lives living in Philadelphia. It takes days to travel. And so he got burnt out. And as you point out, and this becomes a classic story throughout the book, basically, he delegates. So, and in order to delegate, he has to give up some, or in some cases, half of his income. But then, you know, if he had someone running all the administrative sides of his publishing, which is what he did, he suddenly blossomed to become the Benjamin Franklin we know. He, you know, invented the battery, the lightning rod, became a statesman, and so on. But my question is, in your 20s, it's harder to delegate, and also you do have energy to do everything. So maybe slow productivity is not the right remedy for someone in their 20s. Someone in their 20s is just like kick ass all the time, maybe.
Well, I mean, it's certainly easier to not do slow productivity in your 20s, but there is also still a long-term cost if we think about aggregate benefits over time. Because let's take the Franklin story. The flip side of that coin is also the Jane Austen story. They both get at the same point, but with different strategies for getting there. So Franklin didn't start doing cool things until he got a lot less busy. So he gave David Hall, this young shop assistant, you take over the business, I'll give up all this money, I don't care. I want to, you know, invent the lightning rod. Jane Austen did something similar, right? There's this myth around Jane Austen that she would write surreptitiously on scraps of paper, and then like people would come in, like Darling would come in the room, and she'd have to hide it. And it was this trope that everyone knew, that the door to the sitting room had a creak, and when she would hear the creak, she would hide her writing. It all turns out to be nonsense. During the socially busy parts of her life, she got no writing done. It wasn't until later in her life, after her father died, her and her mom and her sister and a friend were like, we're done. They went to this cottage that was owned by their brother, started wearing common laborer's clothes and working in the garden, no more social engagements. They're just like, we're just going to take a break from life. She wrote 5 books in 5 years. Like all of her famous books were done there. So there's this lesson there. When you're busy, you can't do great things. So yeah, when you're in your 20s, you can get away with being very busy. Like you can do it. And it's not a bad strategy for advancement as well, right? In a world of pseudo productivity, the 25-year-old's the person that can be up slamming on Slack all night long and showing people that they're, hey, I'm visibly active. But you're also giving up the time that you could be getting good at things that like down the line are going to make the big difference. You know, Franklin didn't start doing awesome things until he was well into his 30s, because that's when he started working on awesome things, you know?
But it was in his 20s that he was able to set up the scenario that could provide him a lifetime of income, albeit less income than he would have if he stayed devoted to it. But he built the business that he was then able to delegate so he could go off and do what he wanted, because now he had this steady income.
Yeah.
Similar to the story as Jenny Blake in your book, which is she had like 10 different streams of income from her coaching, but she was getting burnt out, so she wanted to take 2 months off a year and reduce her obligations, but she had to reduce the income also. But she built it in her 20s.
Yeah, but Jenny's interesting because she's kind of the answer to this conundrum, right? So yeah, we have this issue of, you know, in your 20s, you're hungry. You know, I gotta make money. I gotta establish myself. I mean, Franklin had nothing, right? I mean, he had to hustle. He showed up with, you know, the proverbial dime in his pocket in Philadelphia and just had to somehow make it work. So then how do we balance both of these things where you have to get established in a world that supports pseudo productivity and you're able to, you don't have the ability to hire David Hall yet or to move to your cottage on your brother's property, but also you don't want to give up the opportunity cost of getting good at things that really matter, right? That long-term are going to really give you the options and the support. Jenny Blake is an interesting answer. So she didn't give up her company. She didn't move to a cottage, but she engineered her life saying, okay, I'm going to take 2 months off every year. And yeah, that's about 20% income. Great. I'll live 20% cheaper. so that I can have this extra time in my life. This is what I think people should be doing in their 20s, not necessarily taking 2 months off specifically, but engineering in time, really well-protected time, where I'm going to just be working on core skills and become really good at it. All my other work, I have to make fit around that. And you know what? You will. You get more efficient. You get more careful at what you say yes or no to. But don't start at 100% saturation and busyness. Start with a commitment to at least part of my day is towards the slow development of something that matters so that you have that rewards of the compounding interest of skill building. So when you hit 30 or 35, you're not just starting then. You're like, I'm a great writer now. I'm a great coder now. I'm a great artist now. I've been developing that skill. So, I mean, I agree with you. Your 20s are probably, you know, you got to hustle, but don't hustle 100%. Start from the very beginning, protecting your sort of Google 20% time.
And do you think that's more possible than people think? Like, this reminds me of a story where it's like in the OOs, I'd already written a bunch of books, or maybe, no, it was like 10 years ago, so like 2014 or so. I'd already written a bunch of books, and I went out to dinner to see some friends I hadn't seen in like 10 or 15 years. The whole dinner, they were talking about the books they were going to write, the plays they were going to write, and it's 9 p.m., 10 p.m., 11 p.m., and I'm thinking to myself, how are you guys going to do anything? Because you're up this late, now you're going to wake up late, there's no time to do anything. I sort of feel people have more time than they realize. And you know, there's a concept of time auditing. Like people don't, like I know one guy who's been on this podcast, David Levine. He started writing murder mysteries just by writing a page a day on the subway ride to his work every day. Like, cause you kind of have a hidden gaps of time where you could, not that you want to fill up every moment to your point, but you do have these moments that are wasted that people, yes, they're resting, but maybe it's like wasteful resting.
Yeah. I mean, I think that's absolutely true, especially when you're young. You have a lot more give. I mean, young people often approach work like in this bullish, let's just get after it type of mindset, not realizing how inefficient they are. I mean, all throughout grad school, I was writing books, which people around me thought I was crazy, but grad students aren't very organized. And I was like, okay, this isn't so hard. Like, be 50% smarter about time management than like the average grad student, which means like, you know what day of the week it is, right? I mean, this is not a tall order. And I'm like, oh, there's plenty of time. This is fine. And it's not like it was an easy grad school, right? I was in the theory group in the computer science lab at MIT. Like, this was a pretty hardcore grad school, but there's a lot of time. You know, I was writing people, my students hate when I talk about this, but I was writing a book while writing my doctoral dissertation. Because I was like, there's not enough to do while you're writing your doctoral dissertation. Like, how long can I spend each day working on this? And what am I going to do for the rest of my day? Everyone is saying like, just focus on your dissertation. I was bored. So I wrote an unrelated book at the same time. So I'm with you on that too. You make the time and then try to make everything else fit. And then you realize, oh, I can actually make a lot more fit than I think. There's so much more give than people realize they have. Most of what they fear turns out to be not, I'm not going to get enough done. It's much more about these social interactions. Like, well, what if like a boss doesn't see me respond? Way more of what we think of as necessary work is more about necessary sort of negotiation of the social capital surrounding work. And that's its own issue. But it's not the workload that's going to kill you. That's not really what they're worried about. It's the like, what if someone notices I can't go to a meeting at 9 a.m. because I'm writing right then? I think that's where people really get more worried.
You know, and there's also this mythology of speed. Like you know, you have the story of Jack Kerouac where, by the way, I always thought he wrote On the Road in 3 weeks, which is the myth of Jack Kerouac until I read your book where essentially you describe it was 6 years of drafts and then revisions and so on. And so it's I think also, and there's this concept of forgiving yourself if you're not fast. Even the people who seem like super fast really took years to either develop the skills or they started playing with an idea and then it developed over time. And it's time really that compounds, you know, the outputs of your productivity, not speed.
Yeah. And you see this time and again. Like I took scientists were a good crystallization of this, I thought, because they really get to this point well. That's why I told the classic scientist stories. You zoom in on the actual TikTok CVs of the greatest scientists from history, it's all over the place. It's like, wait, you took 20 years to actually write down the Principia after you had the original insights about the inverse square law, when the apple fell from the tree. Newton, what were you doing? Galileo, you timed the swinging pendulum lights in the church with your pulse, and it was 5 years later until you actually bothered to write that down in a paper. Marie Curie, you're like honing in on the radioactivity theory. You're isolating it in this substance called pitchblende. You're finding radium. You're going to win a Nobel Prize for this work. You're honing in on it. And you're like, oh, we're going on a 3-month vacation. You know, so like scientists get at this great. We're like, oh, Einstein, Galileo, Marie Curie, Newton, how productive. They changed the world. But they're over time. Like you zoom in, Galileo really loved playing the lute and was very into poetry and theater. And would, you know, they took their time working on things. This is something I've pointed out as early as my early writing career when I used to write about successful students. I had this phrase I used to call the paradox of the relaxed Rhodes Scholar. I said, I know some Rhodes Scholars. Why are they not as busy or stressed out as a bunch of these pre-meds that, you know, I see around me? And I was like, because you see their CV and you collapse all the things they've done and you imagine, what would it be like to work on all of these things at the same time? Oh my God, how would you even find enough time in the day? But they don't. They do one thing after another. They just keep going, and eventually it all adds up into something really impressive. You know, we can't compress time out of the picture. And so it's like good news, bad news. Good news, that means you don't have to be working 50 hours, you know, the next 3 days on your work. Bad news is you kind of always need to be working on something. So you can't aggregate results if you're not producing things to aggregate. So it's like, that's the bad news. But the good news is you don't have to work 12 hours today. You know, you can go slow but steady.
It's really true. And it's scientists are a good example, or writers are a good example. Like we look at their bios and we think, like, I'll take an example of a story, not in your book, but like Larry David, who created Seinfeld and also obviously writes the excellent show Curb Your Enthusiasm. He's in his 12th season of Curb Your Enthusiasm. So we think, oh my gosh, you know, 0.1% of shows have 12 seasons. Must be an incredibly hard worker, and he probably is. But sometimes there's 5-6 years between seasons.
Yep.
And that's not in the biography. The biography is he has 12 seasons of this show. Yep. Or, you know, Thomas Pynchon has these 6 or 7 excellent novels. People forget there was like a 20-year gap between, you know, Gravity's Rainbow and whatever came next. I forget. But I always think, and I think maybe this is true for everyone, I always think if I'm not putting up a win every year or every few months or every day in some cases, everyone's going to forget about me and I'm going to lose everything I built. And I think the misconception I'm having internally is that is the quantity versus quality. If you put out something quality, it brings everybody back even more. But, you know, quantity means nothing.
I think that's right. I think that's exactly right. Like the quantity, I mean, outside of, and maybe this is a social media effect, right? Because it gives you less opportunities throughout the given year to put something out that's impressive. But that is like a theme I come back to again and again. It's over time that's what matters. And because of that, why be stressed out about today? Like this is how I describe my writing output. I write a lot, right? I mean, I write books pretty commonly. I do 20,000 words a year for The New Yorker as well. I always say I write a lot. I'm always writing, but I never write a lot. That's the way I think about it. Like, it's just a part of my day is like, I'm not happy if I don't write some. But I very rarely write a lot. I'm very rarely writing at night. I'm very rarely doing really long things. It's just, I write a lot over time, not a lot in any one day. You know, I wrote this morning. What, an hour and a half. I'm working on a piece for The Atlantic. Not a big lift at all. 90 minutes of work. Not a big deal, but if I do that every single day, you know, exempting Saturdays, it adds up. And you're like, oh, here's 7 articles and I got this book done, you know? That's a lot of things. That's Larry David. I'm always kind of working on something, but never too hard. Like, it's just, let's be working on something cool, but keep the pace reasonable. You know, keeping a natural pace is maybe harder now than it used to be before. I think pseudo-productivity makes it harder for sure. But when you look at these
classic... So pseudo-productivity being, again, the concept that...
Activity matters.
Both your brain and your bosses and maybe your spouses are judging you based on how many hours a day you're, you know, hitting a hammer against a stone.
Yep. How visibly productive are you? And again, this gets really bad in knowledge work because digital tools give you all of these ways of signaling productive activity that we didn't have before. So now it's like, I got to be answering like emails and Slack, and the whole thing becomes like kabuki theater. Hey, look, I'm a worker. See, I responded to your email really quickly. And so that pushes us to be like, I got to be busier. And then what's the irony? We produce a lot less Larry David shows. We produce a lot less New Yorker articles. The good stuff can't get finished because we're so exhausted trying to be busy that we can't actually do the good stuff. And it's the cruel irony of it. It's not like if you work really hard, it's tiring, but you also produce a lot more work, so it's a good trade-off. When you do the really busy pseudo-productivity game, it's not just that you're exhausted and it's hard. You actually do less of the stuff that matters. So it's a double whammy. It's there's an irony to it that's almost tragic.
I think also it's not even just about producing. It's about learning who you are. So for instance, take Benjamin Franklin. If he spent 20 hours a day working on his printing business instead of outsourcing half of his time to someone else, maybe he never would have realized he was interested in the elements of electricity or, you know, what was politically going on in the world and so on. Like, I find when I don't have things to do, it's when I find what it is I'm really interested in.
Yeah. Well, it's the trap of being smart too, right? So smart people have a really hard time with pseudo-productivity because whatever game you fall into, you realize I can do good at this. Like, that's Ben Franklin. He's like, oh, I can win at the game of printing. Like this, okay, I get it. I won here. I expanded here. I can outdo you. I can outmaneuver you. Because he was smarter than most of these other people. I mean, if you read, I was reading the H.W. Brands biography I really like, even more so than the Isaacson biography. He was just smarter than the other printers in Philadelphia. Like they just, it was a different, they didn't have the same like at all costs capitalistic mindset. And he was just really well read, had a very quick mind. And just like saw that. The problem is that's so appealing. So when you're smart, you're like, well, let's just keep rock and rolling with what we're doing. I can win at the game of pseudo productivity. And you're right. Then you never get the downtime required to find yourself. And like, that's what I think, for example, Lin-Manuel Miranda did. So I really get into his story of writing his first major play, In the Heights, which won a bunch of Tonys. We forget about it now because of Hamilton, but it won a bunch of Tonys. It was a triumph. I think 8 Tonys it won. He took 7 years to write that. And when I really broke down the story beat by beat of what he was doing, what he stopped doing, how he came back to it, a lot of it was he had to just discover himself more. Like he wrote a version of that play in college. He was at Swarthmore and did a version of the play at Swarthmore. And it wasn't good because he was 19. You know, he didn't have just the self-awareness and creative maturity to make a Tony Award-winning caliber play. So he had to take a while and take breaks and work on other things because he just also wasn't ready to produce that, right? Discovering yourself is not just navel-gazing. It's ties back to what you do. You know, you see what's important in the world. You see what matters, you know? So I'm completely with you on that.
Go spread the word. When you get a fresh, hot McCrispy from McDonald's and you can feel the heat coming through the bag, don't try to wait till you get home. Always respect hot chicken. The McCrispy. Only at McDonald's. Ba-da-ba-ba-ba.
With threats to our nation waiting around every corner, adaptability is more important than ever. When conditions change without notice, quick strategic thinking is crucial. And with obstacles consistently impending, determination is essential in overcoming them. It's this willingness, decisiveness, and resilience that sets Marines apart. With our fighting spirit, we don't just fight battles, we win them. Marines are the constant our nation counts on to fight the unknown. And through adaptable problem solving, we do just that. Learn more at marines.com.
So it seems like there's three parts of this slow productivity. There's one is forgiving yourself, because I cannot tell you how many times over the years, over the decades, I've either felt guilty or other people have tried to make me feel guilty for taking some time off. Like, it's just part of society that if you're not working every hour, you're guilty. Then it's a matter of, you know, making your schedule fit who you are. Like, again, I'll take Jenny Blake, but also your story of Paul Jarvis. They didn't want to, or Paul Jarvis in particular, doesn't want to make $1 billion, wants to live a happy life. Yep. So he structured his income and his life so that he could, all his needs are taken care of, which is all you really want anyway. You want freedom. And he's a happy guy and, you know, doesn't work as hard as he could have. He could have made a lot more money, you know, scaling his business, you know, charging more at the same time and so on. But instead he figured out the schedule that worked for him to have downtime and be happy and so on. And then I guess the third part again is delegating and understanding the trade-offs. You know, Benjamin Franklin reduces income, delegated. I will tell you a tipping point for me was the first time I ever hired somebody to do a job I could have done. That was such a freeing moment for me. Even it meant money coming out of my pocket to pay someone else. Like, and it resulted in me building a business because I realized I didn't have to do everything myself.
Well, and I had a similar experience with my podcast, for example, because I have my rule, half day a week. And I was doing two episodes and I was doing all of myself. And I was like, I'm having a hard time fitting this or whatever. And so that led me like, okay, I'm going to hire someone. I'm going to go down to one show per week. So first of all, I'm going to give up downloads and I'm going to hire someone so that I don't have to touch a computer, you know? And that made such a big difference because then I could just focus on the podcasting. But I want, the point you're making there more generally, I think is such a great one. It's like you have to, it's two things. Get over yourself and get into yourself. And like what I mean by that, I sort of just invented that phrase now, so you have to bear with me, but I'm thinking
about
it.
That's the title of your next book.
It should be, right? And I'm just thinking about this now, but so tell me if you buy this. The get over yourself part is you're not going to be the best in whatever you're doing anyways. Like at some point you have to get over the fact that you're not going to be the best and also no one is really tracking you and care as much as you think, right? This is a freeing thing for me. Again and again, I've had this experience in my life of being taught that lesson, right? So like I'm a smart kid in college. I'm breezing through my computer science undergrad. I'm just like, this is easy. And I go to MIT and it's like, this is what smart looks like. And I'm like, oh, that's not me. All right, I get it. You know, I'm not Richard Feynman. These people are, right? And you just knew, like I'm never going to be as good at doing mathematics and theory as the people who are here on this floor right now. I start writing books. I'm going to make my way up the like writing hardcover books. And my first big hardcover book, So Good They Can't Ignore You, did not do well out of the gate. And then I wrote Deep Work. And I remember Deep Work was just coming out or it just came out. And you know they had reduced my advance on Deep Work versus So Good They Can't Ignore You because So Good They Can't Ignore You hadn't yet done much. And I talked to my agent. I remember I was upset. I was like, they're not really promoting the book. And my friend, you know, went into a Barnes & Noble with his family to get a copy. They'd even have it, you know. And she was like, you know, you got to move numbers, right? No one cares about your idea or your promise. Like your last book has only sold this much, so they're not going to put much work into it. I was like, oh my God, I see. So like these other books are just doing much better. Great, I get that. And then I started writing for The New Yorker more recently. And I was like, oh, I see. Like I'm never going to be as good of a writer. So again and again, right? It's just like, you're not going to be the best. And people don't care. Like they're not tracking it. So instead, like do something really well, but do it in like a very sustainable way and get into yourself. Like really understand yourself, what have gratitude for what's going well, build a life that's interesting and intellectually fulfilling as options. Like get into what you care about. Get over the fact that you're not going to be the best. Get over this idea that everyone's tracking you and are laughing behind your back because your book didn't sell as much as this other person's book. I don't know. That's been really good for me. It's hard in the moment, but getting
over
myself.
It's really hard.
Yeah, it's really
hard. I feel like I'm still going through that, and I don't know if I'll ever get over that. Like, well, it's a hard thing.
You can feel it. Like, you know, look, let's do like third wave psychotherapy here. You know, it's like you're always going to feel, especially if you're an achiever, you're going to feel the bad feelings when it's like, man, that thing is doing really well, and my thing isn't, you know, or I was rejected from this. But we can get better at not letting those feelings be so important. You know, it's like, yeah, of course, that's how I feel around book launches. I always get upset and weird, and I always see other people's books, like, why are they doing so much better? And I get nihilistic, but just separating from that a little bit and be like, this is awesome. I get to write books for a living. You know, I'm trying to get better at that. But I think we are driven. This is all, everything I just said was driven by one thing you said, which is you feel really guilty to ever take your foot off the pedal. And it's from this idea of like, everyone is watching me and monitoring me, and they're going to be really upset if they see I slow down. And at some point you realize no one's following you. they care about themselves. They're not tracking your every move. No one noticed that you took time off. No one noticed that this book didn't do it. They're like, oh, you're right. Yeah, whatever it is. People aren't in, as into you as you think.
I don't know if that's true. Which sounds ridiculous.
It is true. It is true. No one knows what no one knows, like, when's the last time I wrote a book? No one knows how well, like, my books did. There's like 7 people who know. They're like, oh, you write books. I read Deep Work. That's fun. And that's it. Like, that's as much as anyone. And I think about all of the sweat I've had about, like, oh my God, if I built my platform properly and what's happening with this or that. It's those people are like, oh, I read Deep Work. That's cool. You write books. Hey, let me tell you about something else I do. You know, that's it, right? That's where most people are.
Let me ask you, like, you've been writing about work for, that's like all your books, and in a very broad sense. So, you know, whether it's, you know, how, you know, So Good They Can't Ignore You, Deep Work, all the way up to this book, Slow Productivity. What do you think, and you, obviously you're very talented and skilled as a writer. What do you think could be another challenge for you? Like, are you going to write another 10 books about work?
Well, no, I'm not. And also, I don't even think about those books entirely as being about work.
No, I get it, because they're different aspects of life.
Well, honestly, I see a techno thread, right? Because think about the book you left out there. Digital Minimalism is not about work, right?
Yeah. And so I think that's actually why I left that out.
Exactly. Well,
it didn't prove my example.
I see it more as tech's impact on our life, right? So computer scientist who has turned to trying to understand how these tools actually impact us, right? Deep Work, what's it about? It's about the rise of these distractions in the office have made uninterrupted focus more difficult, an unexpected side effect of technological innovations like email. So we have to now prioritize that in a way we didn't have to before. Digital minimalism. We're on our phones all the time, more than we want to be. What do we do about it? A world without email, returning to the deep work question, how did we get to this place? Like, why are we checking email once every 5 minutes? It doesn't take much digging to find out that this is a very unproductive way to leverage human brains. So how do we get here? And what would a real solution look like? And slow productivity, like, and I'm stretching a little bit here, but I'm just trying this out. The whole motivating event that kicks off the need for slow productivity is the mix of pseudo productivity with the high-tech office. And those two things don't play together. So I think about it more that way. But what do I want to do next? I want to become a better writer. Right. And like, this is a lot of my program over at the New Yorker. There's a ladder there to climb. I want to become better. Right. Like, that's a place where they care a lot about craft. I'm a pretty good writer. I would like to be a really good writer. And that there's a set way to do that. You got to train, you know, you got to stretch yourself. You got to work with these world-class editors. So I want to become a better writer. That's one thing I'm working on. Two, I helped found this new center at Georgetown called the Center for Digital Ethics. So, you know, I'm really interested in being more formal in these ideas I've been investigating in my books about technology and how do we cope with it, like from a humanistic perspective, like how do we prevent new technology from making our lives worse? How do we leverage new technology and make our lives better? I think that's, there's a life's work maybe built into that, right? So that's a big thing that's going on as well. And so I am changing, right? I can't just write, I don't know how many books I can write that are just going to be, here's an idea and here's advice. You know, I have other things that I'm percolating as well. I have to grow.
Well, I guess I could see those threads, right, in your writing, because I would say the concept of So Good They Can't Ignore You is a very great concept. Like, it makes me think of like Seth Godin style concepts that you know, that's really the key. That's this thread of quality over quantity. And if your work is so good, they can't ignore you. Now you have a career. Like, that's really the essence of making a successful career. But that evolves into like this latest book where it's a book about productivity and work, but now you're weaving in all these different stories. You have stories in that book as well, but here now it's much more this writing style that you've been evolving. And so I see that direction. And it's interesting with the digital ethics. The one thing that it makes me think is that both of these concerns, and it's almost cliche for me to bring this up, but both of these concerns are related to artificial intelligence. Because with artificial intelligence, someone can be a bad writer and write 20 books a year. And of course, with digital ethics, AI is going to be written all over that. And like right now, you're a PhD thesis. Let's say someone's not a good writer and they also have writer's block, but they have to write a PhD thesis. This is why some PhDs take like 8 years, 9 years to finish, because people just don't write, sit down and write their PhD. But now they could put in all their formulas and say, write a thesis around this, and they could write their PhD thesis in like 5 days. And you have to be a good writer now to really stand out from, I see it now every day in the news. I can tell which articles are written by AI. It's too many adjectives, too many adverbs.
Yeah.
It's a little too glowing without being analytical. But no, maybe other people don't realize that because it's got all the facts, so it's written. And obviously AI has a big role in ethics, but I think both these directions are going are somehow related to AI. Plus the idea of productivity. Again, I can write my PhD now in 1/10 the time if I want to.
Well, I mean, AI is definitely something I've been thinking about. You know, I did a big New Yorker piece last year that was just trying to, I think it was like one of the first big pieces to get in the guts of just how a large language model works.
I really want to read that.
Yeah, no technical terminology. The New Yorker does not do technical terminology, all analogies. Let's really explain how these things work. And that was interesting because that article then sparked off a lot of one-on-one and group meetings. I did multiple Senate briefings after that, for example, a bunch of board of directors meetings. Like, it was really interesting, right, to see how people were thinking about this. Then I have another big AI article. I'm working on it now. When this interview comes out, it'll probably already be out in the New Yorker, looking at the shortcomings of language models and what the next generation, I think a lot about it. When it comes to writing, though, so I'll give an optimistic, skeptical take, which is it's true, for example, like when it comes to writing books, that AI will soon be able to write like pretty good books. But here's the thing. There's already a ton of people that could write a pretty good book, but they don't because there's not a big market for pretty good books, right? Like, in other words, you already have to stand out just to sell a book. So like AI is catching up to what like an average college educated person could write if they spent a lot of time. Maybe what it's automating more is the time, not the output, but there's not a big market for that because there's a lot of people who could do that and they don't, because what do you do with like, this is like a perfectly reasonable book. Perfectly reasonable books don't sell, I guess.
That's a really good point. That's why I was more interested or focusing on short articles. So like gossip article, if you read a gossip article on the web, like, oh, Kim Kardashian's now dating so-and-so, I bet there's like an 80 or 90% chance it's written by AI. And PhD theses, I don't think are written yet by AI, but actually should be. Because like the biologist with the thesis is not a writer, and the writing is slowing him down from getting to his career or her career. They should use AI to write a poorly written PhD thesis, which is what most PhD theses are.
Yeah, well, I mean, more importantly, probably also is non-English speaking scientist allows you to actually much more effectively get your work out there, because English is the language de facto of science. Thesis is, again, I have a little bit of skeptical optimism. The hard part about theses in most field is not the writing. I used to have this argument a lot. When I was early in my career, I did a lot of appearances at what are called PhD or doctoral or dissertation boot camps. So like Georgetown or nearby universities, you have a bunch of doctoral students who are writing their dissertations. Like, we're all going to get together for a week and like encourage each other. And they would often have me come by because back then I was seen as the like student productivity guy. And they would only ever use this verb, writing. Like, you got to get your writing in. That's the problem. You're just not doing your writing. We need more time for writing. And I would always push back. And I was like, writing's the easy part. It's like having the idea to write about's the hard part. Like, I'm a mathematician. It's incredibly difficult to solve a proof. That's like what I spend 90% of my time doing. Oh, and then I have to write it up afterwards. That's not the hard part. My problem is not, don't just tell me, hey, write every day. It's how do I solve really hard math proofs when I don't know how to solve it? And it's actually the case for a lot of fields, even humanity fields. It's like, I need an original theoretical framework for understanding this that's like literate and interesting and smart. And they get stuck not because writing's hard, but because their idea is not quite there. And if it's not quite there, people will know. So I always think there too, like the writing's not the problem, it's the ideas. But I will say this is where I'm excited about AI intersecting with academia. Is mathematics. Now, language models can't do mathematics in any sort of interesting way. When you combine language models with planning engines, which is a big push going on, and that's what my new article is about, when you combine AI models with planning engines, which can simulate into the future, this makes it possible for them to tackle a lot of more non-trivial mathematics, in particular, like simplifying equations, You can set up like a probability function and it can try to, you know, simplify a concentration bound. A lot of stuff that I don't think the average person doesn't necessarily understand, that a lot of science, a lot of has a lot of applied mathematics where it's just a pain and it's really hard. It's hard not because it's interesting, but it's just hard to manipulate equations. That's like most of theoretical physics. 20% having the big idea, 80% trying to make these equations simplify and find equalities, right? It's algebra, right? It's very difficult algebra. It's what slowed down Einstein. He's very good at math compared to you or me, but was not very good at math as compared to theoretical physicists. And it really slowed him down on general relativity because his math chops aren't there. AI might be able to help with that. Mechanistic applied mathematics. And I just know from my own work as a theoretical computer scientist, that could have doubled my productivity.
That's interesting. I believe that Matt, you know, because AI is going to have all the techniques for theorem proving at its disposal, whereas the average even mathematician might not have those techniques. And
it's not even going to be theorem proving. It's going to be more like, okay, I want to show this this probability that I'm expressing as this equation is bounded by something like this. And then so can you simplify this equation? Simplifying equations is like 50% of applied mathematics. And it's just really hard algebra. For whatever reason, the researchers I was talking to, like mainly at Meta, because they'll actually talk to reporters still, they're saying these planning engines combined with language models, they're really good at that. Simplifying algebraic equations, it's one of these sweet spots where these new technologies are going to be good at. So it would be like Einstein could have got general relativity 3 years earlier if he didn't have to teach himself, you know, Riemann spaces and non-Euclidean geometry, if he could have just had help with that hard math so that his brilliant ideas could be out. So anyways, I'm optimistic about that. Applied mathematics is going to be much more accessible, which means we can select more for people with brilliant ideas. I mean, not to harp on this, but this was my problem as a theoretical computer scientist. I was pretty good, but I'm not a great mathematician, and that slows me to hell down, you know? If I could have help on simplifying probability expressions, I really do think I could publish twice as much. You know, I think I would have more. I have some awards, but I probably have twice as many awards. You know, it really would make a difference.
Now, I'm just curious, like this is like a side thing, but
yeah.
You, while you're doing all this computer science stuff and while you've been a professor at Georgetown, has writing these other books and writing for the New York, all this kind of stuff, this outside activity, did that help or hurt you getting tenure?
No, it was a no-op. It was essentially not mentioned in my tenure case, right?
Okay.
Because, I mean, there's a lot about academia people mix up, but like when it comes to tenure, it's simpler and harder than people realize. The vast majority of a tenure decision is based on a collection of confidential letters that are solicited from top scholars in your particular academic niche. And these letters focus on one thing: how good is their research? Like, how impactful is it on the field? How interesting and hard is it? Who would you compare them to in the field of people who like recently got tenured or at their same rank? Who is better than them? Who is worse than them? Where do they line up? It's like recruiting for a basketball team. It's incredibly myopic. And that's everything for a tenure decision. There's some things you can do that can disqualify you. So like if you have abysmal teacher ratings, they might say, there's a problem here, even though he's a great, if you're a great researcher, they'll overlook it, but you could hurt yourself with that. But you can't get tenure on anything but confidential letters from top scholars looking at. So when I went up for tenure, I had written my fifth book, I think had just come out. There was a little paragraph somewhere like on my service statement where it's like, oh, also I impact a broader community by doing writing and like there's a lot. And that was like a paragraph. So it's a complete no-op from a positive perspective. And if anything, the negative is it takes up a lot of time. But yeah, you do not, and I just went up for full professor. I emphasize this stuff more because now I have the Center for Digital Ethics and I'm trying to argue that this is part of that. But still, that case is, here's what I wrote, here's where it was published, here's the awards it won, and they go out and they get letters. How important is the scholar? That's everything in research universities. It's your research.
Okay, I didn't know how the tenure process worked.
Yep.
But listen, it's all part of the same thing, that it's like slow and steady wins the race. And it's part of this concept of slow productivity. And I have to say, I really enjoyed, you know, not only the concepts in the book, but all the stories. You have everybody from Benjamin Franklin to Jewel, who's been a guest on this podcast as well, to friends of mine like Jenny Blake or Paul Jarvis, or, you know, so many stories about writers too. John Grisham, Jane Austen, you know, Clive Cussler. It's just great stories, great concepts. Really important for me as I've been going through what I feel is slow productivity, but again, combined with this guilt that either I impose on myself or others impose on me. And I feel like I've taken too long a break from writing another book. And so I was thinking about that while I was reading this book. I encourage people to read it just to have this sort of self-reflection about how their own work is satisfying their needs. But Cal, once again, if you've been on for every book except the books that appeared before this podcast started. So that was over 10 years ago. This is like your fifth time on the podcast. Thank you so much for coming on once again. I really appreciate it.
No, thanks, James. It doesn't feel real yet when I write a book until we've talked. So now I can actually feel like, okay, this is a thing. I have a new book out. So,
yeah, exactly. That's important.
Remember the Thai cave rescue? What about the mission depicted in Black Hawk Down or the epic rescue shown in Captain Phillips? You've probably heard of all of these, but did you know that the U.S. Air Force Special Warfare played a pivotal role in all of them? These airmen are the most highly trained warriors on the planet. Other forces like the SEALs and Army Rangers call on them to provide skills no one else can. Not many people make the cut. If you think you can, visit airforce.com to learn more.
Go spread the word. When you get a fresh, hot McCrispy from McDonald's and you can feel the heat coming through the bag, don't try to wait till you get home. Always respect hot chicken. The McCrispy, only at McDonald's. Ba-da-ba-ba-ba.